Good morning. Welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Harriet Williamson is the producer for the show. Kyle Mabry's at the controls. In just a bit here, we'll be talking with Stefan Kanfer. He writes about film. He's written biographies of some of the Golden Age film stars, Groucho Marx, Marlon Brando, Lucille Ball, and we will talk with him about the film career of Humphrey Bogart. And he's written a biography of Humphrey Bogart. The title is Tough Without a Gun, and it is published by Vintage. It's out in paper, and it's got some good stories in there about this great star. So we'll talk with him in just a moment. We have 2 days left in our springtime fundraising campaign. And that's what we're doing here this morning, have been doing here for the last couple of days, asking people to support the station with their dollars. And it's very important. It's what makes public radio work, the fact that listeners are not just listeners, they're also financial supporters. They're helping to pay the cost of the programs. So when you listen to a show like this, you have to appreciate the fact that the reason it's here and the reason it's here commercial-free is that somebody has called or gone online and made a pledge. And we hope that you will be among them this morning. This would be a good time to do it. Here in the studio with me is Molly Delaney. She's our education outreach director for Illinois Public Media. And I'm happy that she could be here in the studio with me to encourage people to either make the call or to go online.
Absolutely. And this morning, you know, I'm sure that there are people out there wondering, well, does this really matter? You know, what impact does my contribution have? And we've talked about this before. The spring is kind of the time when we're creating our budgets for the next fiscal year, which starts July 1st. It's the time when we're really thinking about what we want to emphasize here at the station. We're getting feedback from our viewers and listeners, and we're listening. And that's how, you know, based on what you enjoy is kind of how we move things forward. And in addition to, you know, you just making a contribution because you want to support programs like this one, I didn't realize this until we had a budget meeting last week, that our viewer and listener support actually increases the amount of federal money that we get, which is, you know, so you think about, you're making a contribution of $50, you're making a contribution of $100. Not only is your contribution supporting programs like Focus, but it's actually supporting the station by increasing the amount of federal dollars that are eligible for us to receive. So if you needed a little push, I think that's a great reason to nudge you toward making a pledge. If you already made a pledge of support, consider increasing your pledge. If you've never made a pledge of support, now's the time to do so at 244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, in this part of the show, we're happy to have as our guest Stefan Kanfer. He has written about a lot of different things. For example, he's written a history of the De Beers Diamond Company. He's written about Yiddish theater in America. And he has written biographies of some of America's great film stars, including Groucho Marx, Lucille Ball, and Marlon Brando. His most recent is The Life of Humphrey Bogart. The title of his book is Tough Without a Gun. It's now out in paper. It's published by Vintage. And it's got some great stories in there about this great star. Someone who was not conventionally handsome, and as an actor, really not particularly versatile, but certainly he was somebody who, in the words of the author, had a quality that was at once dangerous and sympathetic. 50 years after his death, the American Film Institute ranked him the greatest male legend in cinema history. So as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Folks want to join in the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email, if you'd like to send in a question that way, is will-talk. At illinois.edu. And Stefan Kanfer, hello.
Hello. Delighted to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And I guess the thing that's really striking, one of the things that's striking about Humphrey Bogart is, you know, he passed away in 1957, and probably his most loved, highly regarded, best work was done over a relatively short period of time. He was in a lot of movies, but probably the best movies came, let's say, between about 1941 and 1951. So given all that, it's remarkable that in many ways it seems like actually he's never left.
Well, for one thing, he's in iconic films. He wasn't just an iconic star himself. Casablanca, for example, is a film I think probably the whole world has seen. There are not very many Americans, including kids, who really hate black and white movies, who haven't seen it.
Yeah.
and the Maltese Falcon as well. And, you know, later on when he began to be in Technicolor films, which were very late in life for him, they became iconic too, like African Queen, where you have two people who are not young falling in love, and yet that also worked and became one of the most films I think that America has ever put out. So he just managed one way or another to choose the right vehicles for himself.
Mm. Well, was that something that he did, or was that something that people understood, or was it something that maybe also some directors, when they had a project, they thought, well, this is the guy that we have to have?
Yes, I think what's happened with Bogart is something that hasn't happened anymore. He had a very, very long apprenticeship. It was 19 theater plays before he ever got to Hollywood. He struck out a lot in Hollywood playing second villains. He said of that period that he spent more time writhing down on the floor than he did standing up, because he always got killed by the hero in them. But he learned his craft so that when he finally did become a star, and he was 42 and he did, something unheard of. Now, you could have Brad Pitt at 42, but he made it when he was, you know, 25. I think when Bogart made it, there was already a sense of self. He knew who he was, and the directors knew who he was. As you say, they bought into a quality they know they could put on screen. He was a very reliable performer. He believed there were only two kind of actors, professionals and bums, and he made sure that he was one of the professionals.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, you know, I'm sure that there are many stories that come out of Hollywood at this time. Well, it's still come out of Hollywood where things happen and it's just maybe luck or good fortune, or someone who is better known is offered a part, and for whatever reason that person turns it down and somebody else gets it, and for them that's a huge break. And for example, I think about of all of the movies that we associate him with, Casablanca may be one of the top ones, but the other is going to be The Maltese Falcon. Mm-hmm. And that was a movie where he was not the first choice. They wanted to have George Raft, and George said, I'm not going to do this movie. And that Houston guy, he doesn't know what he's doing. I'm not working with that guy. And so Humphrey Bogart got the part, and of course, this really was the thing that made him a big star.
Yes, but you know, years ago said that it isn't enough to have luck, and it isn't enough to have talent. One must have the talent for luck. Somehow Bogart always got lucky, because I think he was shrewd enough to present himself at a time when he had the opportunity and to make the most of that opportunity. Somebody else could have come along and been in The Maltese Falcon, and it wouldn't have worked. Bogart gave something, and indeed he furnished the ending. The ending was supposed to be one in which Sam Spade, once again, is kind of a wolfish person who sleeps with his partner's wife and no woman is safe and so on. And he became very noble in this one. He sent Mary Astor over to the cops because she had killed his partner. And when the policeman says, "What is that, Sam?" And Sam Spade is holding the Maltese Falcon, which, as we know, because everybody has seen it, I'm not spoiling it for anyone. It's a worthless piece of lead. And he says, "It's the stuff the dreams are made of." And that line, it's Bogart's line, it was not in the script. So he did more than just accidentally luck into a good part. He made that part.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that, because actually John Huston lifted an awful lot of the dialogue directly from Dashiell Hammett's book.
Yes, he just told his secretary to type all the speeches and put it together, but they still didn't have the ending. They had everything else. And the rest of it, of course, is the magical cast. You have a man like Sidney Greenstreet who made his film debut at the age of 61 in there, and he looms as kind of this half-comic, half-very dangerous villain. It sort of gave the film a moral or an immoral weight as well. So it made Bogart look all the handsomer and all the more incorruptible.
Yeah. We have a caller. Let's talk with him, someone who is calling from Chicago on our toll-free line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Great program. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know if this is a little bit far afield, but as far as Bogart goes, what I've heard, I don't know if this is true, but I've heard he was born to quite a wealthy family. And his mother, I believe, was a painter, and they ended up with his picture on the Gerber baby food. Now, I don't know if there's any truth to that, but that just seems like a wild story. But my question is, and I'll just hang up, my question is, does your guest, was being a movie star, was this something that Bogart, you know, was in his genes, and was that something he truly wanted to do, or was it something that happenstance he kind of fell into it? And I'll listen off air. Thanks.
Okay. Well,
let me address a couple of things. First of all, caller is absolutely right. Bogart was born to privilege. His father was a prominent surgeon, and his mother was the best-known illustrator of her time, Maud Humphrey. He was named after her. That's not a stage name. Humphrey Bogart is his real name, very strange name for a movie star. And he was not the model for the burger baby. She used someone else, although she could have used her son, but that's not true. In any case, the other part of the caller's question is, did Bogart sort of train for this in his genes? Not at all. He didn't know what to do. He was kicked out of all kinds of prep schools like Andover. And he went into the Navy, didn't make success there either. But his father and mother knew, because they vacationed in sort of rich areas, they knew a Broadway producer named Brady. And Bogart kind of got started as a stage manager, doing functioning things, making sure the props were in place, and then tried out for small parts. And he was one of those, tennis anyone, sprigs, they called them, you know, men in flannel who invited the cast to leave the so they could clean it up for the next scene. And gradually he sort of fell into parts. And one day a producer said, you know, something very strange, this kid. People look at him instead of the stars when he's on. He has some aura that we ought to use in some way that isn't just kind of flighty. And they put him in a role in the Petrified Forest as Duke Mantee, who's a villain. And this is not at all what Bogart was used to, even in his long apprenticeship. And came on unshaven and dangerous and snarling the way we know him to be, and he was a huge success, and it just changed his life.
And that was after having he played these juvenile second leads on the stage. He went out to Hollywood and actually got some movie work, but with the same kind of parts. And it wasn't until he went back to the stage and was cast in Petrified Forest, and then when the movie was made, Leslie Howard said, "Well, this because they had played together on the stage." She said, "No. It has to be Bogart," because they wanted to have, I think, Eddie Robinson, actually.
Eddie Robinson, and they would have, except Robinson wanted too much money. And they said, you know, Jack Warner didn't like to be pushed around by actors anyway. So he said, well, all right, let him go. We'll use this kid, Bogart, see how that works out. And it not only did it work out well for Bogart, but it worked out for Warner. So he was happy. Everybody was happy with that film. And Bogart was one of these men who always paid his debts. And when his daughter was born, he named her Leslie for Leslie Howard, who was killed during the war. And he never forgot that break that was given because Leslie Howard insisted that Bogart have that role.
It seems, though, that the curse of having one successful role is that that's what they see you as. And that then, though, after that, after Petrified Forest, he continued to be cast. He was cast as gangsters then.
Yes, he was. And you know, the truth is that Bogart did not really have a wide range. He couldn't do comedy. He was uncomfortable in Western clothes. So what you had to do with him was to make the gangster into something else. You could make the gangster a private detective. You could make the gangster somebody who owned a nightclub in Casablanca. It was essentially a character who could be pushed only so far. And as it happened with Casablanca, that character became America. America was isolationist. It was attacked, and it was pushed too far. It became patriotic, and that's the story of Casablanca, and it's the story of so much of what Bogart did. He just became that likable gangster, or that warm gangster, or that psychopath who is extremely understandable, as in, for example, when he played Captain Quigg in the Caine Mutiny. Mm. There was always Bogart under all that. And I think people love that idea, and that's what made him a superstar.
Well, it strikes me as that in some ways the kind of the characters that he played looked ahead to a male lead that we see now more, but I think in that time you didn't really see because you saw people who were sort of purely good or purely bad, and he managed to create these characters that were much more complicated, and that maybe had dark sides, but also, you know, they were the guys that had a certain set of principles that they lived by, and you know, they had a certain sense of honor, and yet they were capable of a violent act if that was what was called for right at the moment.
I think that's very discerning. He though he may not have been a wide-ranging actor, he had great complexity, psychological complexity, that he gave to the characters. You could see him thinking. You could see that, you know, when he was too far, when he was pushed too far. And also, he had a great sexual charisma, but he never pursued the girl. Somehow, they were always forcing his hand. He was always studiously indifferent. And that made him even more desirable. And, you know, when they started reviving the Bogart movies at the Brattle Theater at Harvard, this was the master of cool, and all the girls fell for him. All the, you know, 18-year-old girls would fall for him all over again and wish that their boyfriends were like that.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you know, we've talked about his long popularity, and certainly is very true. There was a time that there was something of a decline. Maybe understandably, maybe in the 1960s. And here I think that you also credit another important figure in film, Woody Allen, for really reviving the popularity of Humphrey Bogart.
That's true. And Play It Again, Sam, once again you saw the cool manipulator of women. And he was advising the schlep, Woody Allen, how to romance women, when to be cool, when not to be cool. How could I come to her? And the Woody Allen character asks, and the Bogart character says, "The length of your lips." You know, lines like that were just perfect for making Bogart at once a caricature and at the same time one of these people one is nostalgic for. Where is he gone? Why aren't there people like that anymore? So I think that was a great help to the revival of Bogart. And then there are channels like TCM, Turner Classic Movies, that keep showing old black and white movies. And we realize what a treasure is there. You know, it takes a lot to get a kid, young kid, to watch black and white because they think, well, life is in color. Why shouldn't movies be in color? But life really isn't in color, and not in the way that we see it with our eye. It's always a little funny up there on the screen. And I think black and white is very good for certain kinds of drama and melodrama. And of course, Bogart, who was, Houston told me once that when you met Bogart on the street, he was a pleasant-looking man and intelligent, but that's all. And yet, when he was on the screen, he became a noble figure because you had to light a face at Warner Brothers in those days. And Bogart became something more than he was. Yeah. He was born to be a screen actor.
Yeah, and that's something I think people don't appreciate, is that black and white, shooting in black and white, it's not just the absence of color. This is something that is very demanding, and particularly when it comes to your understanding of light and shadow. And that those things come through very dramatically when you see a film that's in black and white.
Well, the other thing is they were able to shoot deeply. Because you could do a lot of shadows and darkness. You know, and it's celebrated. Casablanca was shot really in the back lot and made it look like Casablanca. And they had no foreshortening or very little foreshortening. They had midgets who were taking care of the plane and in the rear studio, which is about 300 feet away from what we were looking at, to make it seem that we were farther away. They could do little tricks like that. You could never get away with that in color,
yeah.
But in black and white you could.
Yeah, the thing that I think of, there are so many moments in this movie that are so dramatic and illustrate that. I think the thing that I think of is, you know, there's a moment in the film when it's after the police have closed down the nightclub. And Rick goes up to his apartment, which is over the club, and he comes in, and the room is dark, and Ingrid Bergman is there waiting for him. And the light falls on her, and she's crying.
And she's one of the most beautiful women ever.
And her tears, they look like melted crystal. I mean, it's just, it's stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And you don't get that in color. You cannot get an effect like that in color. But in black and white, you can.
It's interesting. Color is, not only does it fight drama, it fights comedy. All the great comedians of the 20th century, all of them, course, Chaplin naturally is black and white, but everyone you can think of, Jackie Gleason and Lucille Ball, all of them began in black and white, and that's what established them. When you have color, it's Danny Kaye with the Goldwyn Girls, and the comedy stops so they can sing a song, and they don't build any momentum that way. And when Bob Hope became a latter-day Technicolor comedian, he was no good. It was when he was in black and white that he was sharp and funny, and the timing was better. And it wasn't just that he got older, it was that he had thick color. And it's something that is glorious when you're doing Lawrence of Arabia, not so much when you're doing intimate city melodrama.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour of focus with Stefan Kanfer. We're talking about the life and work of Humphrey Bogart. He's written a biography that's titled Tough Without a Gun, and we'll talk some more in just a moment. Here I want to talk with you about something else, and that's about why it's important for listeners to support the station. You know, we do this show day in and day out, and we're fortunate that we don't have to break the conversation for commercials. Well, it's just public broadcasting, but I think I hope people understand that when we say public, that means you. That means the people who listen. The reason that it is what it is, and we do this the way we do, is because people who listen think it's good enough to pay for. That's what it's about. That's what we're doing here when occasionally we say, okay, folks, now is the time. Now is the time. This is our spring fundraising effort. We'll be here today and tomorrow, and that's it. Then we'll go back to doing our regular thing. But before we do that, we want to hear from as many people as we possibly can. If you can call 244-9455 or go online, willpledge.org, and make a pledge of support. That means helping to pay what it takes to make these shows. Molly Delaney is here with me.
You know, David, I'm a big fan of Focus, and I made that pretty clear around here during pledge drives. But I think about why I am a fan of Focus, and I was thinking, as you know, you were talking about the black and white films and kind of those movie classics. There's a lot of reasons that are similar as why people are fans of those types of movies and why they last forever and why Focus has been around for 30 years. And I think about, you know, really Focus does a great job of kind of shining light on different topics, much like a black and white film does, so that you're really getting to those subtle nuances of that topic as opposed to kind of the sound bites that you'll hear on other radio programs. And that discussion about building momentum, you know, through that use of black and white and just kind of the subtlety of Bogart's characters, kind of that same thing happens in Focus too, where you're building momentum around a topic as opposed to just talking about it or throwing it out there. Those are some of the reasons that I value this program. I also, you know, just want to say it has legend David Inge in it as well. And it's the stuff dreams are made of. Okay, he's going to...
And when we started the show, we did it in black and white.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Yeah, the old shows, they're in black and white.
Well, if you enjoy this program and you enjoy that kind of classic feel to a radio show, we want to hear from you this morning at 244-9455. It's a very easy thing to do. You can go to willpledge.org. You can use your credit card to make a payment. It couldn't be a simpler thing to do. If you haven't done it before, get to a phone, get to your computer this morning, and let us know that you support this program.
Okay. We're talking this morning in this hour with Stefan Kanfer. He has written biographies of some of the great figures in Hollywood, Groucho Marx, Marlon Brando, Lucille Ball, and also he has written a biography of Humphrey Bogart. The title of the book is Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart, and is published by A Vintage. We did have a call a little bit earlier that mentioned the fact that he did come from a well-to-do family. His mother was an artist and his father was a physician. So he was somebody who was born with a lot of advantages. It seemed, though, parental love maybe was not one of them.
That's true.
Was that something that you think was important in shaping who he turned out to be?
Well, I think it was also very difficult for him to relate to women. He had two sisters. He was the only boy. I think both sisters had some mental difficulties, and I think his parents had... His father eventually got hooked on drugs, not the kind that we think of today, but pain-killing drugs, because he had a very bad bone break due to an accident with a horse-driven cab in those days, and it was set badly, reset and so on, and he began taking pain-killing drugs and never got off of them. And his mother prepared drinks, and I don't know, it was not a paralytic alcoholic like Brando's mother was, but it was a difficult house to grow up in, and I think his mother Maud was never very warm. She sort of never hugged him, just sort of clapped him on the back. He took care of her in her old age, but it was never one of those close relationships. And I think it's one of the reasons why he got married 4 times, each time to an actress, I should add. But I think he never really knew what to do about marriage, and yet he was a real gentleman. He was not the sort of person who played the field. He was faithful to the wives in succession, but he just, I think, was a very confused man about that whole business.
Yeah. Well, he had certainly, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall were one of the great screen couples of all time, and they met working on this film To Have and Have Not, and he was 44 and she was 19.
And he thought it was never going to develop into anything. She was a kid, and she, by her own confession, a virgin. So she was, very naive, trying to act sophisticated, but not really. And here was this quite sophisticated, battered, old, by our standards today, old man. And nobody thought it was going to work, and Howard Hawks, who was the director, was furious about it. But they couldn't stop it. They were so terrific on screen together, and as it happened, in life together.
Yeah, they were married 12 years, and the only thing that ended their marriage was his death.
Yes, he died of cancer, and he died, I watch him, we all do, you watch him on screen killing himself because he's smoking all the time. And people who drank, and he liked his booze, and smoked both, have a very high incidence of esophageal cancer, which is what he had. And it was a very painful, long death, but it was one of those things that I think is such an ad for non-smokers if you just see what he's doing to himself. It's very sad.
I remember a long time ago hearing an interview that Lauren Bacall did with Terry Gross, who does the Fresh Air program, and they talked a little bit about that difficult period at the end of his life when he knew that he was going to die, and that he had made his last film, and so he was at home, and in the evenings their friends, other people who were in the movie business, would stop over and they would have drinks and they would sit around and talk. And what I remember is that Terry, I think, asked Lauren something like, well, did you talk about what he was going through? And she said, Lauren Bacall said, no. That they really didn't talk about it at all, which to me, I thought, well, of anybody who you're going to confide in, wouldn't it be your wife? And they seemed to be so very close, but that just seemed to be the kind of guy that he is. He didn't spend a lot of time talking about his feelings or what he was going through or what he was experiencing.
No, I think that is less to do with the marriage than just the way Bogart was. He hated pity and despised self-pity. Couldn't stand it when people started looking at him with sad eyes. He had a boat that he went out on all the time, even when he was, at least at the beginning of his illness. And Claire Trevor was on the boat with him and began sympathizing, and he nearly kicked her off the boat because he couldn't stand the idea that anybody would feel sorry for him. He wanted to go through life as a stoic, and indeed he did. And his doctor said, when a man is ill the way that Bogart was, you learn to see what kind of wood he's made of. And he said Bogart was made of very hard wood indeed. Mm-hmm. And I think that the title of my book, this is not, I didn't make that title up. That's what Raymond Chandler, the famous mystery writer, creator Philip Marlowe, said about Bogart. He was delighted that Bogart was going to play Philip Marlowe because he said, great, Philip Marlowe is tough without a gun, and Bogart is tough without a gun. He doesn't need a gun to intimidate you. But in order to have that persona, I think you can't suddenly let up when you're at home suffering. You keep it up all the time. Your stiff upper lip is what he was.
Yeah, so Chandler liked his Sam Spade?
Yes, I think he felt he didn't like the script much because they were messing around with his dialogue. But he said that Alan Ladd, who was originally up for it, is a boy's idea of what a private eye is. And that's, he didn't want that. He wanted a mature man who gave that kind of integrity to a character who's really very shadowy. If you think about private eyes following people and doing divorce cases and all, it's not really the cleanest of work. But somehow Bogart ennobled it by the way he conducted himself.
Yeah, I guess I'm getting my detectives mixed up here. But I also was thinking about how If you read the Maltese Falcon, that's Sam Spade. You read the Maltese Falcon, the character is described very differently. Except now, and when I read the Maltese Falcon, I cannot help but think of Humphrey Bogart.
You can't, and the ending is so different from the movie, and it's a much better movie than the book is a book, except that, of course, it's Dashiell Hammett, who himself is an iconic figure. Mm-hmm. Raymond Chandler himself said Hammett had no echo. He did very well with what he did. He had been a detective himself, so he knew the routines, he knew the drill, but somehow the writing never had the echo that Chandler gave it. And the other thing, of course, is that a man who's a private detective and writing about his life in the first person would not have that kind of sensitivity, because if he had that kind of sensitivity, he wouldn't be a private eye. So it's always, you're walking a tightrope with that kind of character, and that's the sort of thing that I think that Bogart did much better than anyone else.
Mm. Well, again, we're talking here this morning in this hour with Stefan Kanfer. We're talking about the life and work of Humphrey Bogart. That's the subject of his biography, Tough Without a Gun, and we'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Busey Bank, Bates Commodities, Normal, Inuka Incorporated, Fairmount, and A-Plus Farms Limited, Pine Village. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every day, or every week. No, not every day. Every week. We try to mix it up so there's a lot of variety. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking with Aaron Bobrow Strain, professor of politics at Whitman College. We'll talk about a book that he's written. It's titled White Bread, A Social History of the Store-Bought Loaf. And we'll talk about how it is that bread came to be something that everybody made and moved into something that you just went down to a store to buy, and what that meant. And then in the second hour, the guest is Bruce Hannon. He's an emeritus professor of geography at University of Illinois. A lot of people know him in this area as an environmental activist. He is also an enthusiast of old clocks and has done a lot of work repairing clocks on the U of I campus. And he also was the guy who fixed the clock in the clock tower of the Champaign County Courthouse when it was redone. And we'll talk a little bit about clocks around the campus and about what it is he finds so satisfying when it comes to fixing old clocks. That's tomorrow. You can get the schedule for the rest of the week by going to the website. That's WILL.illinois.edu, will.illinois.edu. We're on Twitter, Will Public Media. You can also check us out on Facebook. And we are here not only to talk about Humphrey Bogart and just generally try to have a good time, but we're also here to encourage people to be financial supporters of the station. We're going to take another couple of minutes here to do that. Molly Delaney is here with me. I'm happy to have her in the studio just to be another voice to try to make the sale.
That's right. So worms, Bogart, bread, and clocks. What do all these things have in common? We make them interesting on Focus.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And there's only 2 days left of this pledge drive. We're looking for $250,000 in the month of April. We're looking for 1,100 pledges during this drive. We're on our way, but, we have a long way to go in the next 2 days. So we really do need you to let us know that this is the kind of programming you value, that kind of diversity that goes from, earthworms to clocks is something that you really appreciate, because really there's something for everyone. So again, urging you to get to your phone, urging you to get to your computer, and let us know that this is what you want to hear more of at 244-9455. It's just a couple days left, a couple days more that we'll take out of our programs to talk to you about this. Every pledge counts. It's the time to let us know.
Yeah. And one of the things that over time I think I has pleased me is I have met a lot of people who said, well, I heard that you were going to be talking about some particular thing, fill in the blank. And at first I thought, well, I wouldn't really be interested in that. But if you can get them to listen to the first couple of minutes of the show, people have told me over and over again, I said, well, I just had to sit and listen to the whole show. And I never would have thought I would have found that thing so fascinating. And when I hear that, I feel good. I feel like, I've done what I should do.
I think you create a lot of what we call driveway moments, where you're listening and you get so engaged in a topic that you really don't leave your car. You may be home, but you're sitting in the driveway sitting there just so you can hear the last bit.
Okay. Well, we have the last bit here. We'll be here for about another 15 minutes with Stefan Canfer. Questions are certainly welcome. People listening can call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. He's the author of Tough Without a Gun. It's a biography of Humphrey Bogart. I mentioned the fact that after having worked in Hollywood and, you know, made a lot of movies, but perhaps maybe not great ones, he goes into this period where he makes the movies that he's really remembered for. And I think really the first of those was High Sierra, and it was another one of these cases where two other big-name actors turned the part down and he got it. This was a screenplay that was written by John Huston, who then would go on to direct Maltese Falcon. Were Bogart and Huston already friends at this point?
They were friends in the sense that when the picture wrap each night, they'd go and drink together. They're both guys who are very literate, like to talk about literature. Bogart was astonishingly literate, and he memorized whole swaths of Shakespeare, stuff you would never think of, but he did. And so they were drinking buddies, and Huston began to realize he had something very special at hand. This is a story, High Sierra is a story about a man who's sort of a mad dog type, who's unfairly characterized by the cops as somebody without a soul. And he does have a soul. He's a murderer in the end, particularly given the movie code. He's got to die. But he dies as a man who really just wants to be free of the constraints of society. He is a misfit wherever he goes. But there's something about him that's understandable and in some way very likable. And Bogart giving that ambiguity a face and even a body was very impressive to Huston. That's why he remembered him when he wanted him to play Sam Spade. It was the one when George Raft dropped out. I want to add one thing to your pledge drive.
Uh-huh.
I've written books on animation, and Chuck Jones, who is the great animator, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and the Roadrunner, and all, really the greatest animator of the 20th century, I think, other than Disney. When television came in 1950, he asked a kid, "What do you like better, radio or television?" And the kid said, "Radio." He said, "Why?" And the kid said, "Because the pictures are better."
I love that story.
Leave that to you. That's my contribution.
Well, I appreciate that because, you know, I've always thought that one of the things that's interesting about radio is that the play takes place on a stage that's in the head of the listener.
J.B. Priestley called it the skull cinema.
Exactly so. And I think that for that reason, the listener is a little bit more active, a little bit more of an active partner than when they're sitting in front of a screen. And that's just my feeling about it as an old radio guy.
I think radio was a very key player in the 30s and 40s when a lot of the actors were coming up and they used their voices in the most unusual way. I mean, practically everybody, when he's a kid, does Cagney and does Bogart, and badly, but nonetheless we did them all. And we did, you know, Cary Grant and all the rest. Nobody does Brad Pitt now. Nobody does the standard, you know, kids coming up that you'd think of now because they don't have very distinctive voices. They may be very versatile, or certainly Leonardo DiCaprio is very versatile, but nobody does him either. And they all did old movie stars because radio was so important and the voice was so important. You had to give that your all. And Bogart and many other actors did a lot of radio at that point.
Yeah. Maybe people would like to hear the story. This is going back to his when he was in the Navy, the story of how he got that little mangle on his lip that produced that sound that we all know.
Sibilance, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are many versions, but the version that I believe is Nathaniel Benchley, who is a very close friend, wrote about, is that Bogart was guarding a prisoner. We all had to do that in the Army and the Navy. At one point or another, you guard a prisoner, and most of the prisoners are very meek. They just go off of you. You have 45 in your belt, and they do what they're supposed to do. And anyway, this guy was handcuffed and asked Bogart for a cigarette, which he was kind enough to supply, and then the guy smacked him. And he had handcuffs, so the metal hit teeth, and it was pretty tough, and there was blood and everything, and it was sewed up rather badly by whatever emergency room surgeon was on duty at the time, So he always had a little bit of a scar there and a little bit of a sibilance. And rather than wreck his career, it made it, strangely enough, because I think, again, that kind of, he had a very musical voice, you know, oh, yes, later you give me millions, that kind of delivery, plus that strange S, and as I said, this is sort of a radio voice, worked very well for him.
Yeah. It's just that there's, he does have that wonderful combination of, I don't know how to describe it. I think about how, for example, in Maltese Falcon, there's a moment where he's trying to persuade Casper Gutman that he's a bad guy, and he goes in there into his hotel room and he threatens him and he smashes a glass and he puts on this big show, and then he storms out. And then it cuts to him walking down the hallway, and he's just grinning. He's got this wolfish grin on his face that obviously he thought he particularly enjoyed just doing that little performance for that character.
There's one more portion of that. I mean, he's done the performance. Then he gets to the elevator, and he presses the elevator button, and his hands are shaking. And he realizes, yes, he brought it off, but he was scared at the time, too. You know, I mean, you don't let it show. That was always, Bogart, you just simply do not let your emotions show. We know what you're feeling, but you don't show it to the villain, in this case, Casper Gutman. You know, and that was a very effective piece of writing and acting, I thought, because it's the turning point of the film, you know, where Gutman realizes or thinks he's up against somebody quite formidable.
Yeah. So who was it that came up with that little bit of business?
You know, again, I think it's Houston and Bogart worked so closely that you can't really tell. It wasn't like, say, Brando, another life that I had written about and know about. You know, Brando really did just wing it. He didn't like scripts. He liked to get the feel of the script and then wing it. Bogart paid a lot more attention to the lines, particularly since Houston often wrote them. You know, you couldn't get away with ad-libbing when the master was at hand. Houston was a pretty demanding guy. I think that was a Houston shtick rather than a Bogart one.
So did it take a lot of convincing for Houston to persuade Bogart to do African Queen?
It did indeed. You know, Bogart's idea of an out-of-town trip was to take his boat past Catalina for 3 miles, and suddenly he finds himself going to Uganda. This is an extraordinary thing that Houston was able to do. But I think that you know, everybody had such regard for Houston, who was a man of integrity and was a damn good director. He made some bombs, but generally speaking, he was a very good director. And you have, you know, Katharine Hepburn signed up, and you have, how can you resist? So Bogart, and also the deal was that he would have his wife along, so Lauren Bacall was there to wash his socks and take care of him. And the other thing was that Katharine Hepburn also had a father who was a doctor, but her father was a urologist, and he believed that you must hydrate yourself at all times. So she brought along case after case of bottled water. The trouble was it was phony bottled water. Somebody had just taken it, you know, out of a pipe and then a top on it, and it was full of dysentery. So she got very ill. And Bogart, who essentially, and Houston, who essentially drank whiskey and ate beans out of a can, got through Africa and was quite healthy about it. So it was a good choice for Bogart to have made, and it was really the cap of his career. He made other movies after that, but that was the one that people remember.
Yeah. One other thing that I'm interested to have you talk about, that this was his involvement in, at least initially, in an effort to protest the activities of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which had targeted people in Hollywood. This was during the time of the Red Scare.
You know, this is something also familiar to me. I once wrote a book. I wrote the first book on the blacklist that was ever published, called The Journal of the Plague Years, which is going to be out in Kindle in a couple of weeks when they revive it. But in any case, Bogart was part of the Committee for the First Amendment, which was protesting the idea that the House Un-Americanities Committee was going to come into Hollywood and choose people who were subverted and kick them out of the movie colony. It was strictly a headline grab and dodge. It was very unfair. It wrecked the careers of people like John Garfield, and it slowed the careers of Zero Mostel and many another, ruined a lot of Hollywood writers. But some of them were communists, but that was beside the point. At this stage, they just did a Krylon spray technique. And Bogart couldn't stand the idea of being pushed around like that. But what happened was there was a group called the Hollywood Ten, They were writers. And it started with the Hollywood 19, and we're called the Unfriendly 19 because they refused to testify before the House Unmanned Activities Committee. Billy Wilder, being Billy Wilder, said some of them were innocent, they were just unfriendly. But in any case, the Hollywood 10 got up, House Unmanned Activities Committee, and put on a show of calling them fascists, that Nazism was coming to America, overstating their case. They shouldn't have taken the fifth anyway. They should have taken the first, which is free speech. Instead, everybody assumed they were guilty as soon as they took the fifth. It was a bad scene all around, and Bogart thought he had been manipulated by these guys, and he dropped out of the committee, as did many others after a while. And people said, oh, it's going to wreck your career. Nobody will pay any attention to you anymore. You're a coward. And, of course, nothing like that happened. Bogart went on with his career. He remained a Hollywood liberal, but not the kind of forefront liberal that you would have found among some of the more activist types. And Houston himself went to Ireland to go live in Ireland. He didn't want to live in America at that time. There were others who suffered greatly because of it, but Bogart didn't want to be pushed around by the right or by the left, and so he stayed pretty much in the center.
You know, we talked a little bit about the relationship between Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and how they met on the set of To Have and Have Not, and then made at least one other memorable movie together. For her, though, was being Mrs. Humphrey Bogart, as far as her acting career went, was that sometimes actually a problem?
I don't think so. I mean, the competing egos are not of the kind that you'd find among two movie stars who simply can't make it anymore. I think what happened was she was willing to take a subordinate position, but she also, I think, knew that it was kind of a nepotism. If your husband is Humphrey Bogart and you can act or you look the way she did, that she was going to get parts that maybe others didn't get. I think he was rather proud of her. What annoyed him, she would get on various kicks, social kicks, and she'd want to have a lot of people over, and he was essentially a loner who liked writers. He didn't like actors that much. Or she would go crazy for Adlai Stevenson, who was running at 1,000 an hour, practically had a crush on him, and that drove Bogart nuts because she was out raising money for a candidate. That he didn't care much for. But as far as two careers running on parallel tracks, I don't think that was a bother at all. And she's had quite a career without him, on stage and in movies.
Yeah, and I think it wasn't the best of her work after he was gone. Aside from the movies that they made together, maybe.
I think that they made two movies that people remember. You know, that's The Big Sleep and I Have Not.
Yeah.
And I think that gave her a great start in her career. But she made some terrible movies after that, even when he was alive, and was just not. She was not up for it. She played an English heiress. She couldn't do that sort of thing. She was not a versatile actress, but. Again, that voice and that look, you just can't beat that. I don't think anybody has come up with anything like that either. She's a very unusual personality. I don't think it's an actress, but a real personality.
Yeah. Well, we're just about the point where you have to finish here now. I guess the thing I keep coming back to is the fact that for a lot of reasons, because movies are different, because the film industry is different, maybe because actors are different, do you think that we will ever have someone like Humphrey Bogart? Not that we won't have good actors, we certainly do, but we will ever have somebody like him ever again?
No, I don't. He was born in 1899, so his roots are really in the 19th century, and I think he's the sort of person that they don't make anymore. I think we should be grateful that we have Bogart on screen, because we'll not see his like again.
Yeah. Well, Stefan Kanfer is the author of the book Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. He's written a number of books, including biographies of Lucille Ball, Groucho Marx, Marlon Brando. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure.